London is no doubt a hotbed for specialty coffee, where you are never very far from an excellent flat white or a unique cup of filter coffee, often from beans roasted right here in the English capital. London is truly a coffee leader. But it wasn't always that way. About 10 years ago, when big chains dominated the landscape with bland offerings in ubiquitous locations, a new scene cropped up around Leather Lane. And while not always a coffee drinker himself, serial entrepreneur Stephen Alish Taylor saw a huge potential in specialty coffee after visiting some of the city's best independent cafes. His next venture became the Department of Coffee and Social Affairs, launched in 2010. Today, Stephen's company, Coffeesmiths Collective, owns and operates a host of brands in food and drink across London and the US. A decade in business, Coffeesmith's portfolio has grown rapidly in the last year, while allowing brands like Department of Coffee to stick true to what they do best and retain their authentic community culture. Stefan is an ex-city financier and award-winning philanthropist with more than 25 years of experience in starting and growing companies, also now a professor of entrepreneurship at King's College London. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bache. For this week's episode, I sat down with Stefan at Midori House to walk through his career, his approach to leading companies and growing brands, and to hear how companies can set themselves up to have real charitable impact. I started by asking where his entrepreneurial journey began.
It started for me in a broom cupboard in an accountant's office in Leeds, which is the honest answer geographically and practically. I left school with an underwhelming academic record. And I'd like to say it was because I had a headache or some history of issue. I didn't. I just wasn't terribly bright at school. So university wasn't much of an option for me. And as a result, I went into the job that people would love to go into or love to go into after university. I just got lucky. And I walked through the door and I got a job as a stockbroker in the days when it was cool to be a stockbroker in the 1980s. Although rapidly becoming not so cool as 1987 and the financial crash knocked on the door in the middle of all of that for me. So I trained as a stockbroker. I qualified as a stockbroker, which was nice. It was multiple choice. So apparently there were me and a whole host of chimpanzees that were able to do the same thing. I decided I didn't like counting other people's money, which is what stockbrokers in my mind ostensibly did. And I wanted to try and make some of my own. I decided I'd go into the illustrious world of advertising, which I guess was very much the sister to stockbroking in the 1980s glamour of business. And I set up my own agency that specialised in putting together celebrities for certain products. And that's how I began in business. And I was a teenager. And I had reasonable success at that. I put together the Harry Enfield dime bar adverts of their day, which were fantastic because they actually spawned a couple of phrases that went round all of the playgrounds of the schools at the time. That immortal phrase, "Oi Nutter," was a hot favourite. And anyone of a certain age listening to this will go, oh, that's where that came from. So I started in advertising and I literally put the deal together in a broom cupboard, looking at many brooms in an accountant's office in Leeds that was my friend Charlie Kay's father's office.
Starting out in the world of finance, that's a pretty short journey to running your own business. Is it in finance where you really cut your teeth as a business leader, though, and really knew that you were going to set out on your own?
No. I think finance and understanding money and how it moves is an integral part of any business you're in. For me, stockbroking was interesting because part of the beginning of that is that you had to read a lot of research notes. So all of the research that stockbrokers publish, I had nothing else to do whilst training except read it. And the more I read over the period of a year, which is what it took me to sort of train and qualify as a stockbroker, obviously the more information I retained because I was interested in it. And I was more interested in that than I was Shakespeare, hence my exam results versus what happened as my career moved forward. And I was very inspired by entrepreneurs of the day and industrialists, really, because there was glamour with it. And for me, being part of that or trying to be part of that was an exciting prospect. That and the fact that the rules were, there were no rules. So as an entrepreneur, you make it up as you go along, usually in the early stages. And that had a lot of appeal for me.
We talk a lot about on this show about the idea of certain sets of people being unemployable. And people will say that. Did you feel you were unemployable at that state in your life? Because I think you said to me when we first met that you never really worked for anyone. You didn't work at the bank. You ran the bank. You've been working for yourself for a long time.
Yeah, I'm laughing because I did go for a few interviews. I'm not going to lie. I went for an interview with KPMG with a gruff Yorkshireman. This was before I became a stockbroker. So it was around those early stages of my 18. I was about 18 years old at that point. And he basically said I looked like the guy that was very keen on getting my hands on the key to the safe, not the key to the executive toilet. And as a result, then I probably wasn't a great fit for KPMG, which I thought at the time was really insulting. And now I'm a little older, it kind of makes me laugh. First of all, who knew KPMG had safes? That's interesting. But I got what he was saying, but not till years later.
So years later, and we're talking about your latest venture now, the Department of Coffee and Social Affairs. This is a business that started out on Leather Lane. But you also said to me when we met that you weren't a coffee guy in your career. Through all these things that you've done, and I imagine lots of late nights and lots of hours spent in the office, you weren't a coffee person. Where did that change for you?
I definitely was not a coffee person. You know, I've backed many businesses that have been startups, and Department of Coffee most certainly was. It changed because for years I didn't take much notice of Department of Coffee in terms of a business. I was busy with other assets and other opportunities. But as always, the way when you have an interest in something, your natural antennae picks up information that flows around it. You know, if you have a certain type of car or a certain brand, you always pick up information about that car or that brand in the press, in the media and anything else. And specialty coffee, not coffee, really interested me because it's a disruptor. And you don't usually associate that word with a 500-year-old business model. Mm. And coffee is a 500-year-old business model. So the idea that something so traditional could be so disruptive appealed to me. But it did take me 4 years or so of, you know, owning a big position in it to really understand just what an important force it is in people's day-to-day lives, ironically, and also as a business movement across different geographies.
And if I understand it, you talk about the difference between coffee and specialty coffee. Around this time, I think early 2000s, it's probably a time where people are saying there's already too many coffee shops. I'm thinking the Costas and other chains. Mm. There's so much of this in our life. Where is there a market for something different, something better? And this is around the time that department is coming up, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think we launched in about 2010. And I remember saying to the people that were originally behind it, yeah, that's brilliant. That's what London needs, another coffee shop. I thought it was like, and me too, what's the point? How are you going to take on these big companies? And only when I was taken for a cup of coffee to two coffee shops actually in central London, one was called Flat White and the other was called Nordic Bakery. Mm. And I had a cup of coffee in those two and I understood exactly what these guys wanted to do because the coffee was so hugely different from the other brown stuff, from the other brands I will not mention, that I thought, wow. If this can be done at the same price, more or less, if this can be done on a competitive level, those other guys are in trouble. And that was my knee-jerk reaction, and I've held that view ever since. And reasonably speaking, you know, I'm not going to say we've proven it. Those other guys are multi-billion dollar businesses. I don't want to be foolish about it, but I think no one would disagree that specialty coffee has got its place now, and it will be tough to unseat it as an affordable luxury in people's everyday lives.
So what is it that sort of really captured your interest? I imagine it's the community aspect, the craftsman quality, all of this, but perhaps good people that are running these shops as well. I think your cafes today feel still like community independent shops, and that's a big part of the brand.
Yeah, they feel like that because they are that. Mm. I think that, you know, this business about independent or not independent, I know that people talk about it. I'm not entirely sure of what the validity is to the consumer, to the customer. Mm. You know, our mission is to give the customers a really unique experience depending on what brand they're in love with. And people are in love with their coffee brands, there's no doubt about it. They can be in love with more than one for sure, but they're quite passionate about it, which is nice. It makes our job easier. So they have an independent feel because no two shops look alike. Definitely, you know, we have a workforce that are genuinely, our team are genuinely really interested in what they do, which is nice. For us, Department of Coffee obviously is very important, but as a business, we own lots of different brands. Mm. We don't tend to talk about it because we never want to be considered so big as we don't care. We are passionate about all of the brands. In fact, you know, we own Nordic Bakery, and I was really passionate when that came up to get it because it was the turning point for specialty coffee for me. So it had a particularly special place for me to get it. And we also understand enough to know that, you know, preserving brands and identity is of paramount importance to people who really love specialty coffee. And I think you can build a big business for sure with one brand, but I think you can go too big. You can dilute your mission, you can dilute your product and your proposition to a degree where another disruptor could come up and thump you hard. For us, it would be difficult because we have some brands that are just one shop, and we'll protect those and the integrity of those with our dying breath. And we have others like department that have practical aspirations it's executing to be much bigger. But there's always a limit at where we go, do you know what? No, we are exactly where we need to be. We're not going to keep going just for the sake of it. There are other businesses that we can buy and help grow, or take a stake in and help grow, using our skill sets.
So we're talking about Coffee Smiths Collective is the parent company that, that has a number of these brands. And perhaps the news hook to our chat today is also that there's another brand that's come into that portfolio, Baker & Spice, which is a London company. I think there's five locations. When we talk about careful growth and brand and sort of protecting that, you know, a lot of people are thinking about grow fast, make some money. But this is a completely different operation. This is really thinking about where we move next and how that works with what we already have.
Yeah, I mean, for us, there's a very strong traditional business skill set in Coffee Smiths Collective, which is the parent of department. And those disciplines have an application across all of our brands, but they don't pollute them. They are light touch operational exercises in order to give our customers the best in class of what they're asking for. And sometimes you have to be a bit bigger to be able to do that. You know, you can buy better quality goods if you're buying more of them, and you can get it at a price that's more affordable to the consumer and also to you as a corporate to make sure you can make your margins to have a profitable business. I think specialty coffee's been notorious for having big brands and actually pretty poor businesses. You know, those that are of a certain size are always looking to grow, but growth in terms of finding new locations is a danger because a lot of it has to involve keeping your fingers crossed. Nobody really knows how a location is going to pan out. They just think they know. And there's data and there's all sorts of techniques to try and work it out. But if they were right, what company would ever go bust? So, you know, what we want to do is we want to basically run around the United Kingdom and the United States preserving brands that people really love by making them part of a very bland, nondescript holding company that you never really hear about, that makes sure that they can buy really good quality ingredients and really good quality coffee at a competitive price, almost like a cooperative. And for us, that's proven to be very successful, and we think it's extremely scalable. You know, in one hand, we're a little odd because we'll be passionate about a particular coffee from a particular part of the world, bringing all of those things that made us special in the first place to bear. But at the same time, we'll start talking about economies of scale, career moves, you know, pay bumps, and all of those more traditional things you expect to see from bigger companies. And only by blending those two things together do you keep it real. I think the danger for specialty coffee, in my experience, having been in the field for almost 10 years in this, is that they're passionate about coffee, but they're not necessarily very experienced business people. And as a result, you know, one can have a serious problem in terms of scaling the business or even surviving. But it doesn't mean to say they don't have great skill sets. You can't be good at everything.
Is that why you have more of a hands-off approach in the daily operation of things then? You own a majority stake in this parent company, but in the overall running of this, you just have the right people in place.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I would say that's accurate. I mean, I always used to joke, the minute you see me running a company, you should probably panic. I'm a builder of companies. I say that tongue-in-cheek, by the way. I don't want anyone thinking they should... You know, I mean, I do run things. Yeah, you're absolutely right. The other thing is, you know, department in itself is a small company. Of course it is. But we are almost 1,000 staff strong between the US and UK now. And there's a heavy responsibility, particularly in this world, in those job preservations, when the high street is being so damaged in the UK particularly, to making sure that you are not reckless and to make sure that all things being equal, you are future-proofing your business for not just the shareholders, but the stakeholders, for the people who give you the time, effort and energy and the best years of their life because they want what they want out of it. And I think that where I'm lucky isn't in my historic successes, it's in my historic screw-ups. So I have a good antennae for when things are going wrong and I can see trouble coming from quite a long way. And that's what experience does for you. And if I bring anything to bear in coffee smiths and department. It's I am an expert in what not to do. Mm. I'm not always an expert in what to do. I rely on people who have been trained in the industry and who understand the detail of their role better than me. But overall, you know, I can see an ill wind blowing. I mean, Brexit was a practical example of what could be an ill wind for us. Mm. And we have taken steps to make sure that we have defended against whatever outcome may or may not occur as a result of that decision that the British public made. Mm.
Tell me about some of those challenges then today for the company, because over almost 10 years, the portfolio has grown massively, the operation has grown massively, but what's the market like? How much has that changed?
I mean, I would say for us, we've grown exponentially over the last 12 months. Mm. So we spent 8 years just on department, getting department as close to right as we can. These things always evolve. You know, we got the wrong locations occasionally. You know, we got the wrong people occasionally. There's lots of things. Anyone who's engaged in a build will tell you, you know, success isn't dependent on how much you get right. It's about how little you get wrong. We've got a lot wrong, you know, that we've had to change, but we consider that nothing more than the evolution of any business that's growing and being disruptive. Mm. Definitely what we've seen over the course of the last 8 years is that people are certainly saying specialty coffee, they demand it in terms of wanting the quality that they want, but also they want more. And I'm not going to tell you exactly what that is because we still have competitors and I'm not giving you any clues. So no, I'm not telling you.
Nothing at all?
No.
Okay, well, what about then the members club model? Because that's something that's also booming in London, but it's something that you will be moving more into here in the UK and the US. How does that work and how does that...
Do you know, I'm pleased you asked that question because now I'm forced to be humble. This is a rare thing for me. When we engaged in the members club model, what we were attempting to do is we were attempting to give people that are on their laptops, that are basically gig workers, gig economy workers, a place to hang out all day and not feel obligated to, you know, spend money. They can relax, they can enjoy it. What we learned was that actually we bought a company called Timberyard. And Timberyard in central London had been encouraging people to come in and spend the day and to buy coffee and just to chill out and make this part of their daily routine to a degree that department wouldn't want to, quite frankly. I mean, if you sit in a department all day and you order one coffee, we're not going to be that happy with you unless you offer to pay the rent, rates, staff and everything else. Whereas in Timberyard, it's very much part of the model for you to stay all day. And they have helpful, easy, light touch techniques to get you to make the most of your day by basically buying coffee and buying food. And, you know, it's relaxed. That is a better model than the one that we launched relating to the members club. So we pivoted. So to be entirely honest with you, we launched it. It didn't do what we wanted it to do. We bought Timberyard, who taught us how to do it. And that's very much the future of how we'll do that. And that's a classic case of we buy a brand, and rather than deploy all the arrogance of perhaps people that can buy things, we recognise the real strengths of those brands, even if they're not huge, in being able to teach us something. And I cannot tell you the amount we've been taught by the 19 different brands that we've acquired in the last 12 months. It's fantastic to see what other entrepreneurs have done and how we can learn from that and dissipate that either directly or indirectly across the broader estate for the benefit of everybody, the customer and the shareholder and stakeholder. And that's what makes this job quite fascinating, actually.
I want to make sure we have enough time to talk about the other side of the business and the other things that you do, including philanthropy. If I'm not wrong, social affairs in the part of the title talks about all the other things that you want to be involved in and doing good. Tell me about that.
Well, the social affairs aspect of Department of Coffee and Social Affairs relates specifically to what the company does in a broader portfolio. So the company dips in and dips out of humanitarian operations that my office has in Africa and in the UK. So it's important to be clear about, you know, the role there. So it's very much driven by my office, and then department takes a piece of whatever we're doing and owns it and delivers on it, which is fantastic. And that's an important part of what department's about. And we publish a social impact report once a year. We've only published two.
Yeah.
Because lots of people asked us what social affairs meant. And when we told them that we were engaged in philanthropy, they were quite irritated. They didn't know much about it. So we publish these reports once a year. We say they're online, have a look at them, and then that's it. We leave it. What I don't like doing, and again, this is deeply, I guess this is sort of more my thing. I don't like the idea of taxing my shareholders by giving their money away to good causes. I like the idea of individuals giving away money to whatever cause they think is important. So departments' philanthropic endeavours are based on two important factors. The first is time. So department staff, part of their job description, if they want to, is they engage in these philanthropic activities as part of their normal 9-to-5, if to call it that. And equally, their intellectual input. So their brains and their time is the value add. The way the things get funded relates to what we call the director's fund. So the directors make money available outside of the business completely to ensure that the, well, arguably the easiest part of the equation, the money, is available or can be found through the directors either sourcing it or putting it up themselves.
When we talk about people leaving a business, selling a business, and successful exits in these things, and philanthropy being a great avenue that they can take, what about this model that you're talking about in that being driven by a business or organized by a business? How important is that, and where did that model sort of come for you?
Well, it came from a very practical situation for me. So I spent 17 years in business up until 2008. And in 2008, a lot of the things I was involved with that were very, very successful were wiped out by the banking crisis. And I would like to say that didn't have a lot to do with those businesses. That had everything to do with the fact the banks didn't know how to run their business. But apparently, repayment upon demand, they really mean it. So that wiped me out quite hard in 08. I mean, we were in trouble as a group of people. Matthew Gill, myself, and others were all part of that 17-year journey. We were in trouble and we thought, oh, this is bad. We've got a problem here. You know, this, we could run out of money. We could go under. So we thought, well, okay, look, when we do this again, rather than wait to create wealth and then give it away, because let's be honest, we tried that last time and it didn't work. The wealth got taken off us for a variety of reasons. Why don't we ingrain social impact on the journey? So even if we don't end up making a vast fortune or even a small fortune, we can still be impactful about the things that we care about. And that was the logic. It was, what can you do on the journey to wealth create to help society as a whole in whatever aspect you want to, as opposed to just making a lot of money and then giving it away? You know, Carnegie, the philanthropist, said, look, if you give away your money to people who don't deploy the same skill sets that it took you to basically make that money, you're doing yourself an injustice. So we are very commercial animals, but we are very heavily involved in the third sector. And those extra financial disciplines and those demands for impact and impact assessment and monitoring and evaluation have proven very effective to understanding exactly what effect we're having, both good and bad, in certain areas of our philanthropy. So I'll give you a quick example of that, otherwise it won't make much sense. So we provided thousands of free school breakfasts to vulnerable kids in the townships of Cape Town. These kids are between 1 and 6. So if they don't get breakfast, cognitive reasoning, physical growth, all of these things start to fail. The kids will not be school ready. They'll be underdeveloped mentally and physically. So we provided breakfast and we thought we were all very clever and very good. And we go, and as we always do, we go into the townships, we see the effect of what we're doing, and it was a disaster. If you give breakfast to kids, but you don't actually ensure that they've got sanitation facilities, you have caused a major problem. If you shift people away from ECDs that don't serve breakfast to those that do, but the facilities of those that do are dire, you've now messed around with the economics of that environment as well. And this was a danger and this was a problem. So we recognised we were actually causing more harm than good for the 1 year that we deployed these 35,000 free school breakfasts. So we completely shut the system down, and within 1 month we relaunched it and we rebuilt every ECD that we gave breakfast to. And now we give about 500,000 breakfasts a year into these ECDs. So this was a case where, you know, a good deed was ill thought. And we engaged in a proper intervention and created a 6-point strategy to make sure that those kids had everything they needed in terms of education, a safe environment and food to become school ready. But it was trial and error.
One of the other things that you do in your life is as a professor at King's College London. You were appointed there a few years ago, and actually the Entrepreneurship Institute was a really interesting sounding title and an interesting place. But I wonder if this impact you're talking about is ingrained into what you're teaching and what you're talking about with young sort of curious business minds, and how you can go about doing that well. Because it's often this conversation that comes on this show about who are going to be the leaders of change and making real impact in the world. Is that consumers? Is that business leaders? Is that politicians? But I would wander to say that you believe that would be business owners.
Yeah, I think we're all learning that governments aren't perhaps as reliable as we'd like them to be in many different instances. And I don't think it's just the UK. I think it's probably the world at large is poorly served by its political class at the moment. Not everybody. It's a sweeping statement, and I don't mean to insult anybody, but we can all read a newspaper or, you know, see what's going on the news. And I do think that as corporates get bigger and more powerful, they have a greater responsibility to engage in positive social impact. And I think if they don't, it's reckless, it's short-sighted, and ultimately the consumer will punish them. They will get round to it at some point. So I like the idea of companies of any shape or size doing that which they can reasonably do. And I think that's important, that which they can reasonably do. Small business owners will say, do me a favour, I've got bills to pay, I've got trouble with this and problems with that. Okay, but there are low-cost, high-impact interventions that you can engage in that form part of a positive social impact for your own community and environment. And we've done it, so we understand the difficulties of it. And I think that the more people that do it, the better the world will be, quite frankly, and certainly our world.
In the world of startups now, and mostly in the tech side, the idea is grow and grow fast. And there's so much rapid investment and rapid growth in a lot of these companies. But you're playing something totally different, a slow game. Is there something you can relate to people in that sense on how to be patient in the world of entrepreneurship?
I think, well, I'm not sure I am playing a slow game there, Daniel. I'm doing the reverse. You know, with the coffee business, it's anything but slow. We're not slow to exit. We're not slow to get out of it or sell it the way that, you know, some entrepreneurs will be engaged in that. So it's slow because it could go on, you know, in my life, and, you know, we could be part of it, you know, forever. It's that type of business. I think that, no, the slow game is one that is a luxury. Invariably, a lot of what people are doing now requires being fleet of foot, establishing the broad principles of what you're doing quickly, but then establishing the metrics to sense check that equally as quickly. Because competition has never been tougher, and because the world is moving so quickly and technology is moving very quickly. So I'm going to say it's counterintuitive. I actually think you need to rush to get to a certain point, rush to prove one way or another whether or not your business is workable, and then you need to rush to make sure it's viable. The thing you should take your time on is whether or not or how you scale it. That's the bit where you have the luxury to take a breath. Not rush, because presumably you're either break-even or profitable. Presumably your business is now starting to work for you as hard as you're working for it. And once that happens, be careful the partner you're choosing. Be careful who you're taking money from. Be careful where you choose to launch the bulk of your intellectual and financial firepower. Take time. But you need to rush to get to viability. There's no doubt about it, in my view.
From someone that was not a coffee drinker to someone that has a number of great brands in the specialty coffee area, you're drinking a coffee now, we've shared coffee together. How have you enjoyed this journey in a business you may not have known you were going to go into?
For me, that's been really, genuinely, it's been really exciting. Because most businesses that I've engaged in, I've known absolutely nothing about on day one. And what it's required is really enthusiastic and articulate and clever people to convince me that what they're doing is terrific. In this instance, they most certainly did. But now it's my job to convince others that this is a business that will stay the test of time. This is a business that can not outgrow its quality. And this is a business that's scalable across arguably the planet. It's a little new for me to be able to do that. I mean, I did it certainly in the day, but now I'm back in the saddle doing that again. It's an interesting exercise because it means I've got to sense check everything I do and make sure that, you know, I'm not drinking the Kool-Aid just because I happen to be in love with the brand. I'm in love with all the brands we've got, and if I wasn't, we wouldn't have bought them.
That's all the time we have on today's show. Thank you very much to Stefan Ellis-Taylor for coming in to share the story of Department of Coffee and Social Affairs. Thanks as well to Mirjana LaGrasta for her research help and to Alex Portfelix, who mixed and edited this show. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.